Welcome everyone to the second installment of the year of Cyphera's webinar series, Cryptography Under the Hood. Today we will be talking about TLS and post-quantum cryptography, or PQC. My name is Perttu and I am a cryptographic engineer here at Cyphera, and I will be your host for today's webinar. If you have already found our webinar series and are a returning viewer, you probably know our company already. But for those of you who don't know, let me introduce us real quick. So, Cyphera is a Finnish company founded in 2017. We design hardware-based security solutions using standardized cryptographic algorithms, and we offer implementations of those algorithms as intellectual property cores, or as we say, IP cores. Our product offering includes cryptographic algorithms and protocols. Furthermore, we design our IP cores for FPGAs and ASICs, but our offerings can also be integrated into SoC systems. You can always check our website, cyphera.com, to see more of our offerings after the webinar. If the upcoming presentation raises any questions, small or large, please submit them to the Q&A box that is located close to the chat icon. We will have a Q&A session after the presentation. And for your information, this webinar is being recorded and can be found from our website in a couple of days. Now, let me introduce our speakers. We're joined today by two speakers. One familiar face, our Cyphera's co-founder and CPO, Dr. Kimmo Järvinen. And for the first time ever in our webinar series, we also have a guest speaker. Our guest speaker comes from our technological partner, Intel, Mark Frost. Mark is the FPGA Security and 5G Technical Marketing Manager with Intel's Programmable Solutions Group. Within this role, Mark liaises between customers, sales, and engineering teams worldwide for security and 5G communication topics, and works to create marketing awareness for Intel's portfolio. During his 11 years with Intel, he has held roles in both marketing and as field application engineer, covering programmable technology. Prior to Intel, Mark had worked for 15 years in a variety of engineering roles, spanning telecommunications through the designing instruments for ESA satellites. But without further ado, I'm passing on to you, Mark. Go ahead.
Thank you for the intro, Perttu. So yes, hi all, thank you for joining today. And really, I just wanted to cover a bit about TLS, and what it is, its use cases as we see them, certainly, and then the FPGA value proposition with TLS. And then we'll hand over to Kimmo for, you know, a kind of deeper dive into the TLS and the PQC stuff. So what is TLS? And good old Wikipedia comes to the rescue. They always have this nice succinct statement at the top. So TLS is the transport layer security. It's defined as a cryptographic protocol to provide communications over a computer network. Most people will be familiar with it as kind of a web browser. You go onto any kind of web browser and you'll see your HTTPS. Okay, that's a secure connection between your browser and the server providing the information. And that's the kind of history of this. And if you're old like me, you'll see the picture here in the bottom left. This is the Netscape Navigator from the mid-1990s, right back in a bit of history. So Netscape wanted a way of doing secure browsing, and they came up with this SSL protocol, the Secure Socket Layer protocol, back in the early 90s. Then Microsoft came in with Internet Explorer and they had a slightly different standard. And then it was all getting a bit messy with two standards competing. So the IET created this working group, the TLS working group, to define a standard that we would all use going forward for kind of internet browsing. Now, version 1.3 is the latest today, so it was ratified in 2018. And, you know, it's used super widely in all of our day-to-day tasks. And it's providing confidentiality, i.e. kind of encrypting, decrypting, protecting the data. Integrity to check that no one's kind of messed around with the data. And then authenticity, so you know where the data's come from in a cryptographic way. And you can see from the OSI stack on the right-hand side there, you know, we've got the MACSEC and IPSEC down at the bottom low levels, which is traditionally kind of FPGA space, I think. But you can see the TLS operating up right up in the stack now, up in the presentation there. So we're kind of moving up to the higher levels. So how does it work? It's a client-servant protocol. So normally the client would request a secure connection from the server. So again, let's think about the web browser because it's a little easier to understand that way. The client traditionally would request a connection to the server. So it says, hey, you know, I'm a client, Mr. Server. This is my TLS version I can use. These are the cipher suites I have available to use. The server takes a look and says, okay, well then, this is the best cipher suite we can use together. This is the best version of TLS we can use together. The server then provides an authenticated certificate back down to the client. So usually that will be a signed certificate, which has been hashed and signed with a private key only the server has. And then there'll be an exchange, a key exchange, typically using Diffie-Hellman, with a shared secret to generate a secure session key. And that session key then is used with whatever symmetric crypto has been agreed. So typically that would be AES in some form. So that's the handshake part, which is done first. And then you have the TLS record, which basically is a way of kind of encapsulating the data to send over the link. So there's different record types depending on what type of data you're sending, but it's a way basically of packaging up the data. And then here's where the data is encrypted and the integrity authenticity checks are added. So typically there's a keyed MAC using the shared secret to provide the integrity and authenticity checks, usually by a kind of checksum style at the end of the record.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Exactly like you said, that this is the case, that the handshake protocol is actually the kind of main part of the TLS implementation, and that involves most of the use of crypto, different crypto algorithms, and then the record protocol is just reusing these keys that have been exchanged during the handshake. So. Yeah, that's exactly the case. Yeah.
And I think the version 1.2 of TLS, there's a bit more handshake faffing around going on. There's a bit more back and forth. And I think version 1.3, the latest version, the handshake has been shortened again down to, much less kind of back and forth. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why TLS has been adopted outside of the kind of web browser space, because it actually provides quite efficient mechanism for getting a secure connection set up pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. So TLS 1.3 improves that part quite significantly, and it actually defines as a novelty is this kind of a zero round trip way of establishing the connection, so that you don't actually have to send data back and forth before you can start communicating. So that's one of the main novelties actually in TLS 1.3.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about use cases. We've talked about the web browser stuff because that's traditionally where it came from. But, you know, actually we're seeing it can be used to secure kind of really any kind of transport protocol over a network because of the efficiencies we've already talked about. So probably the number one use case we are seeing is to connect to remote storage. So imagine you've got a server somewhere and you've got a bank of SSD drives. Now, traditionally, that would be connected to the server via maybe PCIe or something like this. So it's very local. But actually, now we're seeing more and more drive bays and drive storage kind of remote from where the processing is. And this NVMe over Fabrics kind of spec was defined as a way of efficiently talking to those drives back and forth between the processing element. There's different ways of doing this. There's a bunch of different options, but the most common ones we are seeing now really are TCP or ROCE, as it's defined, mainly TCP. And here you can see the relevance now when you looked back at the OSI model on the first page. We're going up in the protocol stack. So, you know, TLS tends to sit really between the kind of TCP and the HTTP at the stack level. So here you can see TLS being used and the use case here. And the FPGA is used to accelerate not only the TCP stack, but also the TLS processing, so the crypto stuff. The second use case, and we're seeing this is kind of coming to the fore now, is in protecting content being streamed. So if you're looking at like Netflix, for example, and you're streaming content over that, the TLS is being examined and used in some cases for content provision, not just for high-speed video, but also for other applications, some medical applications. We're seeing more and more use cases also in banking and government as well, because it seemed to be, you know, cryptographically secure. And again, here, this tends to be the FPGA use case tends to be server side. So it's doing the encrypt and heavy lift there. In terms of, you know, endpoint, as it were, you know, right down in the user space, a third really popular use case is this kind of wireline packet sniffer. So looking at, you know, high speed data links, something that can listen in or intercept or in some way look at the traffic on those links, and it needs a TLS decrypt and everything else that goes with that. So we're seeing a lot of use case. And actually, from where we had a few years back, a lot of people looking at IPsec and MACsec, requesting these use cases all the time, and that's still, you know, the case today. But we're seeing TLS really kind of coming in now as a kind of popular request from many of our customers, looking to see what we can provide, what we can do.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. That's actually what we also see in Cyphera is this kind of using FPGAs to accelerate that those heavy computations that are involved in highly loaded servers that need to kind of support thousands and thousands of TLS connections at the same time. And then what it actually means is that you have to do quite a lot of computation. And then FPGAs are, of course, very good devices for accelerating these heavy computations. And actually, the other use case that we have seen in Cyphera is this kind of a security-oriented thing here, that in certain critical applications, it's significant to make sure that the keys are isolated from the rest of the system, and in that's another good point for FPGAs, that you can actually isolate them inside the FPGA, and you can be sure that they are not leaking from the device anymore.
Okay, and actually, yeah, it's a good point. We'll talk about that actually on slide two time. So thank you, Kimo. So, okay, where do we fit into this? You know, as Kimo said, it's quite resource intensive, especially on the server, and if you've got thousands of connections. So you need to manage all those connections as best you can with as few resources as possible. And traditionally in the FPGA space, you're looking at getting the highest fabric speed you can. So how fast can you clock the device means you can then possibly squeeze more in or do more with less fabric and keep your costs down. And so we've kind of really tried to prioritize that with a new family of FPGAs, the Agilex family. So the 7 and 5 here, 7's been out for a little while, 5 is now coming into production. And these guys have got super high fabric speed. So we're seeing customers now trying to do a lot more with less going forward. So you need the high speed fabric. And you can see the span here from, you know, density range 50K up to, you know, 4 million logic elements, lots of onboard memory, particularly transceivers as well. So we've talked about, you know, high speed data links, wireline data links, this kind of stuff. So up to 116 gigabits on the transceiver speeds, support for PCIe, and all the kind of usual stuff we expect to see. So from an overall point of view, there's a lot of product available to support these TLS functions today. And then just to Kimo's other point, you know, the key storage. So again, looking at these Agilex family of FPGAs, we've kind of built this bit of hardware into every device. And actually, we started it back in a previous family, Stratix 10. So we've had quite a bit of experience with this now. This is the Secure Device Manager. So basically, this is what I call like the heart of the FPGA. So it's doing all the configuration, all of the SEU, and all of the security management in one device. It uses triple lockstep microprocessors, which are software patchable. So if some kind of bug or issue is found, or some security threats found, they can be patched by us. It contains a hardened crypto engine. So normally this is really used for protecting your IP. So if you're configuring your FPGA, you've got a bitstream coming in, this crypto engine is used to authenticate, to check the integrity, and also to decrypt the bitstream cryptographically secure. So using the AES or some SHA hashing functions, or again, elliptic curve for doing the signature or checking the signature. And again, all this stuff could be reused later on. But that's the primary purpose here, is to try and protect the IP before it gets to the FPGA, and also when it's running the FPGA, to check no one's messed around with it or changed it in some way. So you can be secure in a kind of root of trust kind of way. The FPGA is doing what you expect it to be doing. We also have some sensors in there for physical anti-tamper. And then to Kimo's point about key storage, so we have these kind of hardened and protected key vaults inside the FPGA that you can use for your asymmetric keys, your public keys particularly. You wouldn't generally put a private key in general, but you could put your public key in here, or hash for public key, and you would store your symmetric keys as well for your AES encrypt decrypt as well.
Yeah, this is certainly something that if we consider, for example, our TLS IP cores, which are of course implement in the soft logic side of an FPGA, then this kind of a key vault would be an ideal place to store like a server's private signing key during the power off, and then when the device is booted, then the key could be fetched from the key vault and written into the TLS IP, which would then serve as the TLS server endpoint.
And also things for like, we talked a bit about the session key setup. So typically with Diffie-Hellman key exchange, you know, we've got some hardened IP in here. If you need to accelerate that Diffie-Hellman key generation in exchange, you can do that here as well as part of the Xyphera IP.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so that is my little overview of TLS and then kind of some of the hardware we can use to support that. I'm going to hand over to Kimo now, so I'm going to stop sharing.
Now you also should see my set of slides. So what I'm talking in my half of the webinar is how will actually the emerging post-quantum cryptography affect the TLS protocol that we just discussed with Mark. So if you have watched any of our previous webinars, you are probably very familiar with post-quantum crypto, but for those who have not participated in these previous webinars and are maybe less familiar with what this is, I give a brief introduction that PQC is a form of asymmetric crypto. So you can think of elliptic curves or RSA as the traditional members of asymmetric crypto. But post-quantum crypto is also algorithms for asymmetric crypto, but they are such that they will not be affected by the so-called quantum threat, which affects elliptic curves and RSA. So if somebody is able to build large enough quantum computer, then there are quantum algorithms that can break the security of elliptic curves and RSA, but these post-quantum crypto algorithms are still secure. And actually, the American NIST organization is at the moment standardizing some PQC algorithms, and that's why it is so topical at the moment. But yeah, in order to see how this post-quantum crypto will change TLS, we first take a look on how the TLS handshake is actually working. So the TLS handshake there are basically two parties in this protocol. So there's the client who starts the communication with a server, and the client wants to establish a secure connection with the server. And in the beginning of the protocol, the client sends the so-called client hello message to the server. And this message, importantly, includes certain fields which define the ciphers that the client is willing to use in the communication with the server. And there, in the beginning, the client says that, okay, now I will support certain groups that I can use for exchanging keys with the server. And in this specific example, the client is willing to use two different elliptic curves for doing that. And then the client will also specify some signature algorithms and then send so-called key share for the preferred method of key exchange in the end of the client hello message. Then what the server actually does, it selects one of these groups that the client is supporting and sends the server's key share for that specific algorithm. So as a result of this key exchange message exchange, then the client has sent its key share to the server, and the server has sent its key share to the client. And by using these key shares, both the client and server are able to come up with the same session secret. Then what the server also sends is a server certificate and a signature using its own keys. And the purpose of these fields in these hello messages are such that these key shares, as I already said, allow both the client and server to compute the session secret and the key that is then used for protecting the confidentiality and integrity of the connection. So that relevant information for that is in the key shares. Then here in the server certificate and server certificate verify signature, but what is the purpose of those is that the client can actually authenticate the server. So by running some signature verifications, the client is actually certain that it is talking with the correct server and not with somebody who claims to be the server. And now if we look at this message exchange from the view of the quantum attacker, so some adversary who has access to a large quantum computer and can break these crypto algorithms that have been used, so what would be the targets of that kind of an attacker? So the obvious target here would be that, okay, it can target these key shares and break either the client's private key or the server's private key by using these public values that have been sent. And what this actually allows the attacker to do is that then the attacker also knows the session secret that is used for protecting this specific session. And then the attacker basically sees all communication that is transferred between the client and the server. But importantly, it's targeting only the specific session. So breaking one session doesn't yet mean that it can break the next or the previous communication between the same client and server. Then if the attacker is able to break these digital signature algorithms that are used for this authentication, then what the attacker can actually do after that, it can basically say or pretend to be the server for different clients, and actually if it's even able to break the certificate or this private key from the certificates that are sent here, then it basically can also create fake certificates for different servers. But importantly, quantum computers that can break these algorithms do not exist today, or at least that's our best guess at the moment, that such machines are not available to any attacker at the moment. But it doesn't still mean that we are safe until somebody comes with such a computer, and we don't have to do anything today, because there is always this threat that somebody is recording all the communications that has been is communicated today, and then just keep them in the storage and break them once the computer comes available, and in that way the attacker could also learn some critical communication that is sent now and break it only after decades has passed.
And just Kimo, just to say here, you know, certainly a lot of FPGA customers are like, security, should we worry about it too much? Because you know, FPGA seem a bit niche maybe. But you know, definitely we're seeing, you know, FPGAs becoming much more widespread, and we do have, you know, some very big customers who take security super seriously, guys providing, you know, cloud services or communication stuff. So security, I think, is becoming a bigger concern amongst the FPGA customer base, and it's not something that we could probably continue to ignore anymore, I don't think, as we have done in the past.
No, I agree you fully here that especially if you're accelerating some crypto communications in computations in critical communication nodes, then of course there can be really high class secrets transferred, and then you have to really take also this kind of threats into account. Yeah, but basically this imminent quantum threat is this record today, break tomorrow. And now we look at TLS protocol from this perspective, then what we see is that actually the TLS authentication, that affects those digital signature algorithms, that cannot actually be broken retroactively. So it's done in the beginning of the TLS session. The client is authenticating the server, and in some cases also the server is authenticating the client. And if that authentication fails or is broken, then it must happen now, because it's only kind of affecting the whether the communication channel is open at all or not. So that's something that you cannot really affect later on. But then this TLS key exchange is completely different story, because that can be broken retroactively. So if you record those communications, you can keep them in the storage for years and decades. And then when you have the ability to actually break the crypto, you can go and break it. And then you know what was communicated then several years ago. So actually, the key exchange is something that we must address now, basically today. If we know that communication that we are sending to the other party must remain confidential for a long time. And you can think of, for example, some nation level secrets that can be such information that they really must remain secret for even decades. So then that is something that we must consider already today. But then we have a kind of a problem that, okay, we have these PQC algorithms that are being standardized at the moment, for example, by this American standardization organization, NIST. But can we really fully trust those new schemes? And the answer is actually no. So they are new crypto schemes, and in cryptography, new is not necessarily good, because then we still don't have the level of trust that we would like to have for our most important algorithms. And there actually are good examples that there have been quite bad failures for different PQC algorithms quite recently. So two candidates that were quite far in the competition were actually broken quite completely just a couple of years ago. So although we have nice and good candidates for the PQC algorithms that will be now standardized, we don't fully trust them yet. So this is why many people actually recommend using a so-called hybrid system, where we combine these new quantum-safe algorithms with the old elliptic curve algorithms, so that if one of them is broken, then the other one is still keeping the security. So breaking one doesn't affect the security, but so you would need to actually break them both before the security goes away. And for this reason, elliptic curves are going to stay in our systems for quite some time. And this is something that many organizations and individuals recommend to do. And this is basically the bread and butter of this talk, that how this kind of a hybrid system will be used in TLS. And now that we are focusing on key exchange only, we can see how it is done at the moment in TLS. So if we are using, for example, elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, which is the most common way of doing key exchange in TLS nowadays, then basically both the client and the server run their part of the protocol, this elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, and get some shared session secret. So both compute their own parts and get the same value. But what they then do is that they don't use that value directly as it is, but they put it into an algorithm called key derivation function, and from there they get these keys that they are actually using for protecting the communication. And the idea of how you do it in a hybrid setting is actually quite simple. So basically you just run these two algorithms in parallel, so elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman and then this new PQC key exchange algorithm. And then you take the outputs of both of them, concatenate them, and put them into this key derivation function and get those keys that you will be using for protecting your communication. But there is a slight problem, that TLS is actually something that kind of defines only a single, is meant to select a single group or algorithm for performing this key exchange. So you basically select a specific elliptic curve or a specific RSA instance to do this key exchange. And there is not really option to choose two. So you cannot say that, okay, now I take this elliptic curve method and this PQC method and then do it kind of separately. But there are some internet drafts that propose how TLS can be actually made to use this hybrid key exchange. And it's actually rather simple way of doing it. Although we need to define two algorithms, we can actually give just one name for this combination and treat it as a single algorithm in a sense. So one of these proposals does is that it basically just defines a name for this combination. Like here in the example, you have this group name SECP384R1, which means that it's a specific type of elliptic curve, and then _ Kyber768, which is a specific type of PQC algorithm. And now it's given as a single name for the TLS protocol, and then everything goes according to the normal way of sending client hellos and server hellos. And you don't actually have to change the kind of the format of these messages. Then the key share that is sent is also just a concatenation of the values for these two different algorithms. So you first take the elliptic curve value and then put the PQC value directly after that and send it as a single value to the other party. Then when you do this key derivation, you again take the output from the elliptic curve operation and the PQC operation, put them together and feed it into the key derivation function. So it's a rather straightforward way of doing it, actually. And this specific internet graph that I was referring to defines four different groups targeted slightly to slightly different use cases. So there are these kind of more secure variants for those use cases that are not running on any constrained devices. And then there are a couple of slightly less secure alternatives with significantly shorter keys that can be used in more constrained settings. Okay, so let's look what the TLS handshake would look like in this kind of a hybrid setting. So here is first, as a reminder, the old how it used to be. And now when we change to the PQ TLS, which basically just use different values in the same fields. So the most significant change here is the size of these key shares. So PQC methods typically have a lot bigger keys. So that's why these key share fields actually consume a lot more bytes. But that's the main difference, actually. So the actual flow of messages and the structure of the messages stays the same. Okay, and then I will end with a few words about our TLS and PQC offering. So we actually just today announced the extension of our TLS offering. Our product family for TLS will now grow with new IP cores for both server and client sides. And these products implement the whole TLS stack, including the TLS handshake and session key management inside a single IP core. And they combine fast performance with high security. Then we have the Exclave, our post-quantum crypto product family, with the efficient implementations of PQC algorithms. And currently that includes Crystal Kyber and Crystal Dilithium. And Kyber especially is relevant from the point of view of TLS because that can be used in this PQC TLS hybrid model that I just explained. And if you remember there was actually one of the suggested groups was using Kyber 768. So that's something that our products also support natively. So we can just combine TLS products from our portfolio with the Exclave Kyber IP cores, and then we would actually be able to do this PQ TLS that I was just introducing on the previous slides. So thank you very much for the attention.
Thank you, Kim and Mark. for this very informative talk from which we all definitely learned something. Now it's time to go through some questions that we've gotten in our QA box. And if you still get any questions, the box is still open, so feel free to ask away. So let's see. First question is, the addition of hybrid methods to TLS seem quite straightforward. Does it have any significant costs?
Yeah, maybe I will take this one. So, well, the most significant cost that I can think of was this that I actually briefly already mentioned that the messages get longer. And that's something that we just have to tolerate with the new PQC methods. So we don't have these nice short keys that we have with the elliptic curves. So let's say elliptic curves consume something like 100 bytes normally. And when we add these PQC keys, they are like more than 1,000 bytes easily. So then doing this hybrid way of doing the TLS handshake doesn't actually affect all that much, whether you do it in hybrid model or PQC only. So you will, in any case, use a lot more bytes in that communication. But that's just something that we have to tolerate in the PQ era.
Then another question. How does a TLS accelerator running on a PCIe FPGA board get shared among multiple host virtual machines?
One for Kimo, I think. I'm not sure. I was just looking at that, thinking, I'm not sure.
Yeah. So reading them. So basically, the accelerator itself doesn't really necessarily handle this kind of things. So the simplest accelerators that there are for TLS are such that they just accelerate the kind of the bulk communication, let's say ASGCM. And then what you do is you actually just give a key from the software side to the accelerator. And in that case, this kind of a virtualization is maybe some abstraction levels higher, but.
Yeah, and also so just thinking about some of the kind of AES engines, a lot of them will run in a kind of TDM type mode. So, you know, per clock cycle, you can do a different encrypt decrypt function. So if you can run it fast enough, then you could manage multiple streams at the same time, one bit of IP, just on the encrypt decrypt. Now, as Kimo says, there's a bunch of other stuff above that. But if you go down to the lower primitives, then yes, it's fairly straightforward to manage that, I think.
Great, thank you. And next one we have, you mentioned that some of the crypto IPs are hardened into the FPGA fabric. Given that the FPGAs traditionally have a long life cycle, how do you plan to handle PQC algorithms?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. You know, if you look at the FPGA lifecycle, it takes, you know, a couple of years to develop a new product and perhaps even longer, you know, going out to the customers, seeing who wants what in the new product, and you start the planning cycle and design and go to production. Then it might be in the field for, you know, we've got some customers still using FPGAs 25, 30 years later. And there's no way to predict what's going to happen, I think. And if you looked at, you know, Kimo slides earlier about, you know, some of the round four candidates were broken very quickly. So it's very hard for us to harden up a PQC function now and an FPGA and say, yeah, in 30 years time, that's still going to be good. So all we can do at the moment is the hybrid method, you know, whereas we harden up what we know is good today. And then you use soft IP from, say, the Zafira guys to do the PQC bit. So we have the hybrid function, and that's really the way we're approaching it at the moment until the NIST stuff is kind of shown to be, you know, proven in use. Maybe, I don't know how long that's going to take, you know, 5 years after it's finalized or whatever, then we can harden. But until that point, we have to go with the hybrid approach.
Yeah, and that's actually, I would say that's one of the advantages of FPGA, that you can still do this update. In more traditional silicon, you cannot. So basically what you have, that's what you have until the end. But with the FPGAs, this is not the case.
Great. I think we have still time for one more question. Let's see. Here we have, are there any limitations for the PQC methods that can be used in the key exchange?
Yes. So the answer is that yes and no. So basically, you can use any algorithm as the second, or in theory, even as the third one, using the same scheme that I was showing you today. But then there are still some limitations, like the size of the key share field is limited to 2 to 16 minus 1 bytes, if I recall correctly. So that's something like 65,000 bytes only. And some of these PQC methods have even longer keys. Importantly, for example, this classic Macaulay's has so long keys that they don't fit into this build. And then this straightforward way of doing things is not possible for that algorithm.
Great, thank you. Thank you for all the questions and your answers and the presentations. But unfortunately, we are running out of time. If your question was left unanswered or you get another question in your mind, please do not hesitate to contact us. Contact information can be seen at the bottom of the screen at the moment. And as mentioned previously, this webinar was recorded and can be seen from our webpage in a video or an audio format in a couple of days, as well as our previous installments of our web series. They can also be found from our website. Cryptography Under the Hood will return after the summer, so stay tuned for the exact topic and date. Thank you all, our presenters and attendees, for tuning in and attending our webinar, and I hope to see you all in the fall.